ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's been 50 years since the biggest scandal in Australian political history.
It really is one of the most extraordinary times ever seen in the national capital.
It's a gripping story about big egos and big mistakes. It's a love story, it's a spy thriller, and there are still secrets left to uncover.
There is a document which is still under lock and key. They will not release it.
You can hear the ABC's award-winning podcast on the whole saga right now. Search for The 11th on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an account of a fracture, a breaking away from the notion that the polite Western liberal ever stood for anything at all. Strong words from seasoned journalist and author Omar Al-Akkad in his powerful new book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This, which has been described as a heartfelt breakup letter with the West in response to its support of Israel's war on Gaza.
I am killing those kids, right? I'm doing that. That's me. That's my tax money. Every morning I wake up and I see the worst possible thing imaginable, right? And I am told that to oppose it in any way makes me the bad guy. Fine. I have some obligation to do something.
And do something he has, including a recent book tour of Australia, where he joined former foreign correspondent Peter Grester at the Canberra Writers Festival. And hello, Natasha Mitchell, bringing you that conversation now on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Peter Grester was wrongfully jailed for 400 days as a political prisoner in Egypt. He's now Professor of Journalism at Macquarie University. Omar Al-Akkad was a journalist and former foreign correspondent with Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper, reporting from difficult front lines like Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay. He was born in Egypt, raised in Qatar and Canada, and is now a US citizen based in Portland, Oregon. He's also authored two novels, but now he turns to non-fiction to give voice to the incomprehensible. Over to Peter Grester on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country in Canberra.
I have to say, I've read a lot of books, and of all of the books that I've read, this one is one of the most moving, the most powerful, the most disturbing that I've come across. Omar, by the way, and I have quite a bit in common, apart from the obvious Egyptian connections. We're both journalists. I think we've both also been described as extremists at various points along the way. Omar, this book seems to me to be deeply rooted in anger and quite a lot of frustration. Is anger too strong a word for it? Are you angry?
Thank you very much for doing this, first of all. I really appreciate it. I can't imagine how much you've got on your plate. I'm still coming to terms with all this convicted terrorism stuff. This is the first time hearing of it. They didn't tell me ahead of time. Anger is one of the words. Grief is another. Uncertainty. And I'm happy to address all three. So I've been on tour for most of this year, for this book. For one reason or another, it gained more traction than probably it deserves to, and that it got published in different areas, and that meant that I'm constantly sort of touring for it, and I'm very grateful for all of that. But one of my trips was right around the time when the Trump administration was first starting to see how much it could get away with in terms of revoking people's residency and so on and so forth. I'm not a resident, I'm a citizen. Nonetheless, I'm also a brown Muslim guy named Omar. And so I was freaking out about a trip to Europe. And I got in touch with an immigration lawyer. And I said, listen, can we have a quick consultation? Because I want somebody on standby if everything goes to hell. And we're sitting there talking. And eventually he says, look, I don't know what I can do for you. I'm an immigration lawyer. That doesn't apply to you. You're a citizen. And I said, yeah. But like, I need you on standby anyway, because who knows? And at one point during this conversation, he sort of stops me and says, look, I'm going to be honest with you. If things go badly for you on your way back, the thing that is going to help you the most is not me. And it's not even your status or your passport. It's the fact that you sound like you're one of us. And it was a very honest thing, and he was right. And the reason I bring that up is because I have spent a lot of my life, I have spent the vast majority of my life, learning how not to sound far away with respect to the center of power in this world. If I called you up on the phone and said my name was John Smith, you'd probably believe me, right? I know how to get by. And if this book has had any traction in the part of the world where I live, it's because it doesn't sound far away. And this brings me to one of the emotions, which is uncertainty. Because I've spent my life being that guy. I'm not that guy anymore. Something has changed over the last 2 years, and I have no idea who the hell I am on the other side of that.
That's really discombobulating, to be uncertain of who you are, your identity.
Yeah, and to have been rewarded for whatever this identity is over and over and over again. So that's one part of it. The other part is anger. I'm the angriest I've ever been in my life, but again, and I've done hundreds of these things now, I know that my voice can't rise above this. Because the second you become the angry brown guy, second you become the angry Arab, the imagination on what you're capable of becomes unlimited, right? You described this notion of both of us at one point or another having been called extremists. I'm the least extreme person I know. There's nothing in this book that I consider profoundly revolutionary. I don't think it's going to be remembered, but if it is remembered, I think it's going to be remembered as one of the tamest examples of its kind. Because all the time when I'm on the road and I meet people at these signings and I meet people at these events, the level of anger is through the roof.
But we were talking earlier, and you spoke about, I mean, you live in Portland, Oregon, which is one of the most white bread liberal places on the planet.
I'm not going to argue against it. Yes, that is an accurate depiction of Portland, Oregon. Please come visit us. We got the guys in the frog costumes. I don't know if you got the news here, but that's, we're the home of that. Thank you to the one person.
And you must have, I mean, I know you've, this book, I mean, you say it's not radical, but you've upset a lot of liberals and a lot of your own neighbors who really take exception to what really amounts to a fairly savage takedown of Western liberalism.
Yeah, none of that is untrue. Most of the angriest conversations that I've had with people who've read this book in the United States are not about my depictions of what is now, and I can only guess and estimate hundreds of thousands of dead Palestinians. That's not the part. It's not the part going into the history of colonialism as it relates to that part of the world and the millions upon millions of people who have died as a result. It's not about that. The angriest conversations and the most confrontational ones have been about the part where I describe this notion of no longer being able to adhere to the idea that I should constantly vote for the lesser evil because the lesser evil has gotten too evil. That produces a level of vitriol that on one hand I can understand, but on the other hand feels so disconnected from my experience of living in the same place. And especially in a place like Portland. Portland is one of the most performatively liberal places on earth. You go to neighborhoods where every lawn has a Black Lives Matter sign. There's not a black family for 20 blocks in any direction, right? Like, and in that kind of environment, writing a book that is, in my opinion, chiefly about the West and chiefly concerned about the chasm between performance and reality as it relates to liberalism results in a level of immune response that virtually no other facet of this book generates.
Doesn't liberalism set the frame, though? I mean, so much of what sits at the core of your book are liberal values, human rights, respect for law and order, respect for due process, all of those things. They sit at the very core. I mean, this is what you're appealing for. And yet you're taking an attack on liberalism.
It's an attack on whatever the hell it is that has assumed the mantle of the things you've just been speaking about and is happy to perform them for me and is happy to send official spokesperson after official spokesperson to the podium to talk to me about the desire for everlasting peace as my tax money is being used by the same administrations to fund endless war. My problem is not with the principles. My problem, again, is with the chasm between the performance and the reality. I live in the United States, where essentially there are only two parties that have a chance in hell of assuming power at the federal level. I love the Working Families Party. The Working Families Party is not taking the White House anytime soon. And I get the fundraising emails from the Democrats telling me that Donald Trump represents an existential threat to the future of the American experiment. And then a few months after the election, I see the leaders of the same party palling around with that guy at Jimmy Carter's funeral. My problem isn't with the principles. My problem is with this chasm and my inability to abide that chasm anymore. I can't see the performance without also seeing the reality.
So what are you asking of liberals? I mean, you're asking for sacrifice. Is that it? You're asking for something more than simply than hollow statements and platitudes. I get that. And I feel that. I mean, the book made me squirm very profoundly because I'm also guilty of hollow platitudes and statements. What is it that you want?
Such a fascinating question. Because what I want is exactly the things you outlined when you were talking to me about what is supposed to be liberalism. I think this to me is one of the most frustrating aspects of trying to present this position. I'm not even asking to reinvent the wheel. And I know a lot of people who are, and I think that they are ultimately correct and certainly braver than I am. Because fundamentally, I think we live under insatiable systems. I think colonialism and whatever stage of capitalism we're in are fundamentally insatiable. There is no such thing as enough, right? And under those systems, absolutely, the only sort of permanent solution is to think of something better from the ground up. But even if you were to write that off completely and say that that's hopelessly naive, right? And it will never happen. We have to learn to live under these, fine. Adhere to the principles that you have been telling me are foundational to this project, right? You don't have to invent them, right? It wasn't all that long ago that bombing the hell out of every hospital in a place was not considered compatible with these principles. I'm not asking you to invent new principles. I'm asking you to adhere to the ones you have, or else tell me to my face, as the deranged right wing in virtually every country I've ever lived in has happily told me to my face, that these rules don't apply to everybody. That people who look like me, who share my ethnicity, who compose the majority of people on this planet, simply aren't allowed into this club. Tell me that. At least I'll know where I stand relative to it. And again, we're back to this idea of the chasm between the performance and the reality.
So you're not drawing equivalence between those sorts of fascists that are saying that we should be bombing the hell out of them, but you're saying at least there's an honesty there.
I can't tell you the number of times I've read an op-ed. I don't know what it's like here, but in the U.S., an op-ed from that camp. And that camp now is not fringe by any stretch of the imagination. It controls many of the levers of federal power in the most powerful nation that has ever existed. I can't tell you the number of times I've read an op-ed that essentially connects the line between my Amazon packages arriving more quickly and those nameless people on the other side of the planet who not only just sort of have to die, but that's kind of what their lot in life is, you know? You know, you wake up and you see a woman in a hijab and she's crying over the mangled body of her child. That's just what those people do. That is hideous in a way I can understand and I can resist openly. But the person who abides the exact same horror and then has a human rights benefit gala in the White House once every few months, maybe they're not in absolute terms nearly as bad, but there is something uniquely insidious about that. And I know it's irrational to be more upset about that, but most of the time I am.
A lot of that, it seems to me, can't possibly happen without a dehumanizing of the people that you're talking about. You cannot carry out the performance, I think, of the liberal performance that you're talking about, but you also can't bomb the crap out of hospitals without dehumanizing the people that you're targeting and seeing them as somehow less than us. And by us, it's almost always the people that we're talking to. Is that what's happening here?
So it's interesting, you and I met this morning for the first time to grab a coffee and at least come up with some kind of game plan for what I did not know would be a crowd of this size. I sort of thought there'd be 10 people here. Thank you all for coming out, by the way. I appreciate it. One of the really refreshing, and we'd never met before, right? One of the really refreshing things about it was that I knew, because of your background and because what you have spent a significant portion of your life doing, that we would not be talking about the same situation except looking through smudged glass at it. And what I mean by that is I could describe to you, for example, certain subtleties in the difference of how I think of a place like Qatar versus a place like Saudi Arabia versus the UAE. I can't do that most of the time. I was introduced onto the stage as having been born in Egypt and then grown up in Qatar, which is correct. I cannot tell you the number of places I have been introduced as being from. He's Egyptian, he's Palestinian, he's Jordanian, because it's just sort of one big smudge on the map and there be dragons and so on and so forth. This is a vital component of this enterprise. You and I in very, very different degrees, and obviously I'm not comparing my work to yours. Yours was in an entirely different stratosphere. But we worked as journalists, right? And the central point of being a journalist is understanding how something works, why something is.
And who it is that you're talking about, what it is that drives them, what's behind the culture, what makes them human.
And there's a reason why a significant portion of this book is obsessed with journalism as it relates to what is not only a genocide, but at least in my opinion, the worst, most overtly horrific thing I have seen in my lifetime. Journalists are, for the most part, pretty damn good at what they do. And what they do is figure out what a thing is, but what they also do is figure out how they can talk about it. And so I don't think it's incidental that some people are shot and some people are involved in a shooting, that some hospitals are attacked and the attacker is named, and some hospitals just seem to sort of spontaneously combust. And even if you don't give a damn about Palestine, this is the case across the board. I live in the United States, where when a black guy is shot by a cop, that's an officer-involved shooting. And the bullet, as though of its own volition, sort of went over and collided with this guy. All of this stuff, I am not willing to accept is incidental or accidental. Journalists are not that oblivious. And so I obsess about that a lot, because without that use of linguistic malpractice, the dehumanization you're talking about becomes much, much harder to render acceptable.
So you see journalists, and we're talking in horrible generalizations when I use that term, but you see that perhaps the enterprise of journalism has actually supported what you're talking about.
I should say...
It's a part of that narrative telling. It's a part of that narrative process.
I've seen some of the best journalism of my life over the last 2 years. Overwhelmingly, it's been done by Palestinian journalists, and most of them are now dead. I have also seen some of the worst journalism of my life. And there's plenty of examples that I use in the book. The British newscaster who described a moment when Israeli soldiers shot a 4-year-old girl at a checkpoint, and his language was something like, a bullet collided with a 4-year-old young lady. I have no idea what the hell a 4-year-old young lady is. I will never be able to understand that phrase for the rest of my life. This stuff matters, right? It's not incidental. Okay, here is my sort of overarching idea of the relationship between journalism and what is happening right now. Set aside the genocide in Gaza. Set aside Palestine entirely. Set aside whatever story or whatever part of the world you want. In every single story, in every single act of journalism, I think every reporter, every journalist has an obligation to think about how they would write that story in a vacuum, absent external pressures. So advertisers threatening to pull their ads, governments getting angry, CEOs getting angry. How would you write the story absent that pressure? How are you writing under that pressure? And what is the gap between those two stories? Because that gap is my definition of journalistic malpractice. And every journalist, I think, in every situation has an obligation to close that gap. The reason that... the reason the institution of journalism is taking such a hit, and again, I don't know what it's like here, but certainly where I live, and certainly among younger people, the reason the institution is taking such a hit is because particularly with the case of this genocide, that gap is so glaring. There are so many good journalists where I live, but the institution has damaged itself for generations because it has allowed this gap to exist, and enough people see it now. And once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Yeah, and I think allowed that gap also to skew the way that we see and understand the story, the way that we see and understand and what has been happening in Gaza.
I mean, it's depressing to say, but again, relative to the part of the world I live in, that seems almost generous because it implies some kind of seeing in the first place. Most of it is to establish a looking away.
Exploring the shortcomings in the Western media's reporting of the war in Gaza, this is the Egyptian-born, Canadian-raised, now a US citizen, journalist and author Omar Al-Akkad, in conversation with former foreign correspondent Peter Grester about Omar's book, One Day, Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. And this is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app with me, Natasha Mitchell, coming to you today from the Canberra Writers Festival.
You mentioned Palestinian journalists, and I was just having a look at the CPJ figures, the Committee to Protect Journalists, just before we came out here, and the CPJ has counted 241 Palestinian journalists killed, 162 injured, 92 imprisoned. That's more than in all of the conflicts since the Second World War combined. That is a truly horrific number. And more disturbingly is that the CPJ identifies at least 30 who have been deliberately murdered for their work. Now, the number is almost certainly far higher than that because the CPJ is extraordinarily conservative in the way that it does its maths. And yet, we've constantly seen the work of Palestinian journalists being dismissed. That must be pretty difficult to watch. It's been tough for me to see. I mean, I know some of those people too.
Yeah. I'm happy to ramble on about this, but I actually like to hear more from you, please. I mean, what has it been like for you?
Well, it's been shocking. I mean, I spent some time in Gaza. I reported from the Gaza Strip at a time when the Israelis were making an incursion. And I saw just how courageous the Palestinians were. The time, I mean, I was there, we were lucky in the sense that we were foreign correspondents, and the foreign correspondents have a degree of protection because I think one of the reasons that we know that the Israelis haven't allowed any foreign correspondents in is because they recognize the blowback and that would follow if foreign journalists were being killed for their work, particularly to the extent that we're seeing the Palestinians. And so I know just how extraordinarily courageous anybody who picks up a pen and puts on a press vest in Gaza has to be. And it's hard to see these people that I know, worked with, care about being killed for their work. But it also, I find it incredibly, incredibly difficult to see the way that their work has been dismissed as propaganda. That's also why I find it very difficult, just and incredibly frustrating to see the way that foreign journalists have been refused access, not because I think the Palestinian journalism has been substandard in some way or necessarily compromised, but because the only way it seems that we're going to get journalism that people believe in is by having foreign correspondents in there. And it's difficult for me to say that, but I think that's the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't disagree. I mean, I was never a full-time foreign correspondent. I don't want to give the impression that I did anything at the level that you were doing. My first foray into foreign reporting, and it was a brief stint, was in Afghanistan. And I remember being really nervous. And I remember it was a sort of fill-in position for the person who did this kind of stuff sort of semi-permanently. And he was explaining to me, I was maybe early 20s, basically. And he was explaining to me for the first time the idea of fixers, which I don't know how many people here are familiar with sort of how the sausage is made with respect to journalism, but essentially, in a lot of situations, particularly the most violent situations, foreign reporters from the West overwhelmingly will sort of parachute into these places. But the way you get a lot of your information is you have fixers, people who are born and raised in that spot, who understand it, who can save you from your worst impulses and say, no, don't go into that village at that time, you idiot, you're going to get yourself killed or whatever that may be. And who in many cases are doing the work, right? So every now and then you will see this in a newspaper article. If you see somebody and it's like, again, John Smith reporting from this war zone, and then at the very end of the article it says, with files from Muhammad. Yeah, Muhammad did a lot of the heavy lifting, right? And sometimes it's for Muhammad's own safety that they are not sort of given more credit. Other times it's because this is the way the world works, right? And so to me, a lot of this is sort of a continuation of the same systems that have been in place for a long time.
And I'm also the first to acknowledge one of the reasons I'm here and not still in prison in Egypt is because my name just had the dumb luck to be called Peter and not Muhammad. It's a tough thing to acknowledge, but it is.
Yeah, and I mean, there's the cynical side of me that's thinking on the other side of this moment, whatever that looks like. Because the first time a white Western reporter goes into Gaza, and we get this moment's equivalent of when the New Yorker ran that entire magazine-long article about Hiroshima, right? A lot of that version is going to be the stuff that Palestinian journalists have been saying for 2 years, but it's going to be a white guy saying it. And no matter how much I want to discount the possibility that that's the thing that's going to cause a change, that absolutely is the thing that is going to cause a change.
At some point, do we not have to say, well, for the sake of change? I mean, as much as I would wish the world be different, and I'm not making a case for the white savior here, but as much as I wish the world were different, if you want to affect change, you've got to drive whatever it is that can make that change.
If you want to affect temporary change, yeah, absolutely. I agree. If we are in a position where this is our avenue of relief going forward, then we also have to admit to ourselves that we've sort of given up on any possibility of living in a kind of world where we're not in this position to begin with. Right? And look, I understand that when white folks go to the protests, it matters different than when somebody like me goes to the protests. I get all of that. I know what kind of world I live in. And I'm torn about this, right? I am uncertain about the vast majority of things, and this is one of them. There are days when I wake up and think anything pragmatic that puts an end to the slaughter, that puts an end to the ongoing oppression that hasn't just been going on for 2 years, it hasn't just been going on for the better part of 100, it is a fundamental element of colonialism, anything that puts a dent in that, fantastic. And then there are days where I wake up and think, Jesus Christ, is this the best we can do? Is hope for somebody who's considered human enough to say the thing that the people who are considered subhuman have been screaming? If that's the case, then the world is working exactly as intended.
Let's shift gear a little bit here. We're talking about journalism, I guess storytelling. This is my segue into this. And one of the things that you write about is the privilege of narrative power to decide when the story begins. And the point, you can say that bad things started from here. And I'm going to read a passage which I think is very powerful. You write, when next this happens, and it will happen again and again, because people remain under occupation and because the relative compelling powers of both revenge and consequence warp beyond recognition once one has been made to bury their child, this same framing can always be used. The barbarians instigate and the civilized are forced to respond. The starting point of history can always be shifted such that one side is always instigating, the other always justified in response. Now, in a funny kind of way, when I read that, I thought, well, actually, I dare say that passage would resonate with both Palestinians and Israelis. There is a sort of dial setting of the beginning of the narrative. Can you talk us through what that really means?
I think one of the central forms of power that colonialism imposes is based in narrative, both before the fact and after the fact. In the early 1800s, the Supreme Court of the United States effectively ruled that there was no such thing as indigenous rights to any of the land in this territory, because a rightful claim, could only be made by a Christian. And I think it's important to sort of gauge the reaction to that now, right? Because The Supreme Court as an institution still exists, and its rulings are still the law of the land and are written in similar authoritative language, right? But it was a narrative that was fully acceptable. And now it's a narrative that if I had come on stage and tried to advocate for, I would never be allowed to back into this festival, and rightly so, right? There is this astounding coincidence at the heart of every instance of colonialism. It's the greatest coincidence in human history. And again, I don't know much about the history of this place, but I suspect this is true of every instance of colonialism. Hey, look, the people we want something from just happen to be irredeemable savages to whom any amount of violence can be done with impunity, right? That is, if I sit here and I talk to you about a group of people who are deemed savages, who are deemed to have no right to their own land, who are penned into smaller and smaller open-air prisons, am I talking to you about the Palestinians, or am I talking to you about the indigenous population of the continent I live in? The narrative has power, and there's an element of it that exists before the fact, and there's an element of it that exists after the fact. Again, without much knowledge of how it works here, whenever I do a literary event in Canada, especially, and now increasingly in the United States, it begins with a land acknowledgement, right? We acknowledge that we are on the unceded territory of the indigenous people. I did an event once in Whistler that might have been the most unintentionally honest land acknowledgement I've ever heard, where the guy got up and he said, just to begin, I want to get the two most important things out of the way. I just want to acknowledge that we are on the unceded territory of the indigenous people, and I want to thank the hedge fund sponsoring this event. It's not to me a question of who this resonates with or not. It's a question of the purchasing power of the narrative, right? Some people's resonating with this description may fully believe themselves to be the last line between civilization and barbarism. Whatever you want to believe, you believe. I don't care. Some people's belief in a narrative moves entire armies and gets countless people killed, and some people's belief gets nothing done. That's what I'm thinking about, who it resonates with. I have no idea.
Sure, but it's about setting the historical dial to a particular point to say that this is the bad thing that started everything, and that everything flows from this point and can justify whatever manner of atrocities we happen to inflict from this particular point. Mm-hmm. In the Gaza conflict, Israel continually refers to the October 7th attacks. That's the day that everything began, that we now need to justify it. We're simply responding to this situation, this existential threat that Israel faces. For Palestinians, it's the Nakba, it's the occupation of the original establishment of the Israeli state and the forced exile of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of Palestinians. That's the kind of narrative I'm referring to here. And that's, as you said, that is the power to establish a frame and to respond to the frame that you've just established in your own interests, right?
On October 5th, 2023, a report came out detailing how that year was the deadliest year for Palestinian children so far this century. I have never once seen that so much as covered in Western press, let alone be the starting point of anything. Anyone can pick whatever starting point of history they want, and that's not even a malicious thing a lot of the time. You have to figure out your framework. Sure, absolutely. My question is not with the idea of picking a starting point and starting your story from there. That's a natural human impulse. Fine, I get it. My question is, how is it that in every single instance of overwhelming violence, the starting point is the one that least acknowledges the actions of the most asymmetrically powerful within that conflict? Why are we in this position over and over and over again? And I suspect I know why. And even setting all of that aside, right? I've had a lot of conversations in which, and I'm not saying this is one of them, I genuinely am not. I've had a lot of conversations where I'm talking to somebody and they say something along the lines of, oh, you don't want these people to be slaughtered? Who do you want to be slaughtered then? And it's indicative of a mindset that assumes that you're either wearing the boot and stepping on the neck, or you're having your neck stepped on and that's it. That is the binary. And if you believe in that, I fully understand why. I'm sorry, I'm saying you. I don't mean you. But if someone believes in that, I understand why the rest of this worldview, where you pick a starting point that justifies anything that comes after, I understand why that makes sense. If you want something slightly better than this, then not only do you have to acknowledge that it's not just a matter of equal and offsetting starting points, that there is an actual history of oppression here and a history of colonialism, but also on top of that, you have to recognize the reality of the situation, that there is an occupation that is recognized by the vast majority of the world. And I'm not going to set all of that aside and say, well, everybody can frame it the way they want, and reality is secondary to that. I just firmly don't believe that.
One of the things you talk about, one of the things you write about in unpacking the response of Western liberals is negation. You talk about walking away from as a form of resistance, of not taking part. By that, you're referring to boycotts and similar kinds of actions. You say walking away is not nihilism, it's not cynicism, it's not doing nothing. It's a form of engagement more honest, more soul-affirming than anything the system was ever prepared to offer. That strikes me, given the kind of criticisms that you've been making of performative liberalism, that still seems a fairly limp response.
What wouldn't be? What wouldn't be a limp response? Put yourself in my shoes, and you're watching something that, again, you consider to be sort of the defining atrocity of your lifetime. And you are trying to figure out, just from a moral level, how to stand in opposition to that. And you live in a part of the world where if you go out to the protests, you might be tear gassed, you might be arrested. In the UK, you might be arrested for holding a sign. Or you might be snatched by masked agents of the state, as is happening in the United States, and disappeared into some prison somewhere. If you write a letter to your elected representative, good luck having anybody even acknowledge any of that. Anything in the framework of violence will result in overwhelming levels of violence. If you try to engage in academic boycotts or cultural boycotts, you are being illiberal. If you try to engage in any other kind of boycott, you are engaged in economic terrorism. It seems to me, and maybe I'm being cynical, that particularly for Palestinians, and to a lesser degree for anyone who stands in any way opposed to their continued occupation and mass murder, the only acceptable form of resistance is nothing. Nothing. And if you're a Palestinian, the only acceptable form of resistance is to die, and to do it quietly, to not make too much of a fuss. So in that context, I could not agree with you more. Everything I have done to try and show any kind of opposition to what has happened over the last 2 years has been completely impotent. Sure. But with respect to boycotts and with respect to not being in the room, all I'm thinking about is that it's a slightly less asymmetrical mode of engagement. The state has a harder time punishing you for what you don't do. Do I think that me not drinking Coca-Cola or whatever is going to end this genocide tomorrow? No. I have ruined my relationship with countless literary organizations over the last 2 years because I've been part of these open letters trying to get literary festivals and awards to cut ties with sponsors who are also invested in weapons makers. Is that going to end the genocide? No. But I am killing those kids, right? I'm doing that. That's me. That's my tax money. Every morning I wake up and I see the worst possible thing imaginable, right? And I am told that to oppose it in any way makes me the bad guy. Fine. I have some obligation to do something. And none of any of these modes of resistance are going to solve this tomorrow. I get that. But living in the most privileged part of the world, benefiting directly from the same forces that are killing these people, the least I can do is try. And again, I come back to this notion of uncertainty, right? there have been moments where I've thought, okay, my presence is going to do more, maybe, than the absence of my presence. There's been literary festivals where I thought I should go and make a fuss about this thing. And there's ones where I thought, no, I don't want to be in that room. And I have no idea if I made the right decision across the board. I wish I had an algorithmic approach to this thing. If this, then that, most efficient way to oppose a genocide. But that doesn't exist. And in anything resembling a halfway normal society, regular human beings should not be walking around with a blueprint in their back pocket for how to best oppose a genocide. People are screwing up left, right, and center. This is one of the modes in which maybe they screw up, but maybe they're part of some kind of action.
I heard you give an interview where, in fact, at least that element you spoke of as a kind of positive thing, as a point of optimism, as a point of hope. Is that right? Is there optimism here? And I'm not trying to put a sort of to gild this thing. I'm not trying to put a positive spin on this. I'm not trying to sort of make sure we end on an uplifting note.
Uplifting sense. Is my strong suit. Yeah, that's right.
But what I'm trying to say is there something that you take away from this as a positive? Because in that chapter you do speak of seeing the kind of actions that you're talking about, the boycotts, the protests, and so on, as being something that still give you reason for people throwing, as you describe it, throwing sand in the gears of the system.
So I'm more hopeful and more dejected simultaneously than I have ever been in my life. And I realize that sounds absurd. As much as I've become disillusioned with virtually every load-bearing institutional beam of the Western world, academic, political, journalistic, cultural, you name it, I have been equally as inspired by what people have been willing to do, right? Individually and community and solidarity with one another. And this is something I come back to over and over again. And I'm glad, if this is how we're ending, that we're ending on this. I've done nothing, right? I did the bare minimum I could do and still be able to call myself a writer. I'm not out there chaining myself to the gates of weapons manufacturers. I'm not riding around in rickety boats hoping to break a siege conducted by one of the most powerful militaries on Earth. I'm not out getting tear gassed. I got a letter the other day from a woman who had read the book, and she was sitting in prison in the UK. She was part of Palestine Action, and she's sitting on terrorism charges right now. I am, for the most part, spineless. I sit alone in a room in the forest in Oregon, and I write stuff. I leech courage where I can find it, and I have found no shortage of places to leech from. All of these world leaders who, in the last few months, suddenly had their come to Jesus moment and suddenly realized that something bad was happening, they didn't wake up one day and see something different. They woke up one day and saw that their own constituents are not going to take this. And each of those politicians' political self-preservation mechanism kicked in, and now I know. I've always known they can be bullied in the direction of cruelty. Now I know they can be bullied in the other direction as well, and that is not a small piece of knowing. There is no doubt in my mind that justice wins, that liberation wins. No doubt, and I am uncertain about most things. These systems that I keep coming back to, these insatiable systems, they have to adhere at all times to a fundamentally fraudulent narrative. And they will consume, and they will consume, and they will consume, and they will consume everything there is, and then they will consume themselves. The thing I have faith in is my central belief that most people have a soul, and that most people know right from wrong. That's what gives me hope. I don't give a shit about the rest of it.
Hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell, and Omar joins you today on Big Ideas here on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app from the recent Canberra Writers' Festival with host, journalism professor and former foreign correspondent Peter Grester. They now take some questions from the audience in the room, and they're starting with an explanation about the title of Omar's book.
I think one of the strange things that has happened, and I should have seen this coming, but I didn't, is that I think a lot of people saw the title of the book and thought, and took it quite literally. I know that there are people who, I think the majority of people on this planet, are against this right now. And I think there are going to be some people who are for this for the rest of their lives and are outspoken about it and are quite proud of it. When I wrote the title, I was thinking of a particular kind of person. In the United States where I live, it is essentially impossible today to find a good, well-meaning liberal who will tell you that at one point they were in favor of segregation. That person doesn't exist. As I suspect, and I haven't been there, that it's impossible to find a good, well-meaning liberal South African who will tell you at one point they were in favor of apartheid. That person doesn't exist. And so that's the kind of person I was thinking about when I decided to make this the title of the book. And I have very little doubt about that person, because that avenue of escape is always available to them. And so it is largely without consequence to keep your head down for now. It is largely without consequence to look up every once in a while and see where the balance of polite society is. And it is largely without consequence later on to adopt the position that this was so horrible and how could we let it happen. That's the person I was thinking about. And I think whenever that day comes, and it may not come in my lifetime, I was not thinking with its title of next week, whenever that day comes, that's not going to be a celebratory occasion for me, because I will never stop thinking about how many human beings were subjected to endless misery before we got from the place we are to the place we always knew we were going to get to eventually. So that's sort of how I was thinking about it.
Madam.
Do you think that this performative gap might have been a bit smaller in the 70s? Do you think cultural relativism, where difference is not just allowed, but broadcast and encouraged, makes it harder?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating question. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. It's interesting to me for a variety of reasons. When I was doing some of the research for this book, for example, there were a few terms that I had thought were purely the result of the War on Terror years that I later learned were not. For example, I think collateral damage, I think the first time that was used might have been during Vietnam. And it gives you a sort of different perspective on, obviously, the things that happened during my time of awareness of the world are the most important things to have ever happened. And that, you know, that kind of worldview is particularly a problem for me. But I think there's a couple of things that happened, and this is a gross oversimplification, I apologize in advance, but and again, relative to the part of the world I live in, there might be similar currents here, I don't know. It used to be, I think, that the house of derangement was furnished the same way. And if you lived in that house, I don't think the derangement was fundamentally different than it is now. I think what has changed is the neighborhood of derangement, which is to say the many, many psychological and emotional amenities that are available to you if you believe increasingly terrible things. And this, in the part of the world I live in, is a function of things like Fox News, for example, or whatever the hell Facebook has become. This idea that, okay, you believe in this form of hatred, you are no longer confined to your immediate circle of people who believe in this form of hatred. Now you can find a yoga instructor who also believes in that form of hatred. Like, the neighborhood has become of such a degree of scale and scope that you can exist within a silo and actually find it so disorienting and, in fact, unacceptable to be presented with any intrusion of reality, or even any intrusion of a different silo. That, to me, is what feels like it has changed in the greatest way. But again, I have a PhD in absolutely nothing, so please take all of this with a grain of salt.
Hey, Omar. I'm Egyptian-Australian, so there might be an Egyptian connection.
We're just going to make fun of y'all for a second in a different language. Just don't worry about it. It's fine.
So you call it a chasm. I call it hypocrisy. That's what it is. And Peter asked about change. We've got a 10-month-old son. And the question that confronts me over again and that I want to share with you is that, what do I teach my son?
So there's this beautiful literary festival in northern Italy. It's called the Mantova Festival, and it's now my favorite festival in the world, not only because it's in this beautiful town that is, you know, one of those Renaissance, like quintessential Renaissance town, but also because the vast majority of the events are in Italian, and because I don't speak Italian, I don't have to go to the events. I can just wander around and get gelato, and it's great. It's fantastic. But one night when I was there, there were a number of activists who decided to do a reading of the names right there. Those kids, Palestinian kids. And they did it at the steps of a church, and I went. They were there for 3 hours before I couldn't take it anymore, because I kept hearing my kids' names. And you shouldn't have to hear your kids' names, right? Like, it's a child. But obviously it felt closer. And these poor Italian people just mangling Arab name after Arab name, you know, just not being able to pronounce the Ayn and the way, you know, everything you'd expect. But it's just doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. And my, you know, my son's too young for any of this. My daughter isn't. She's getting to an age where eventually my natural desire to sort of bubble wrap her and, yeah, is going to have to give away. And I've been trying to think of how to explain this, right, to the two most kind-hearted, decent human beings I've ever met in my life. And I don't know. I have no idea. None. And I have instead been trying to sort of work my way around in this very circuitous way of talking about how to be in this world, how to exist, how to be a decent human being in a world that is so indecent so much of the time, not because most people are indecent, but because we've handed the reins of control to profoundly indecent human beings. And I found myself coming back to something that has, one of the many things that has affected me profoundly over the last 2 years, which is, I don't know how many of you know of Aaron Bushnell, the person who self-immolated outside the Israeli embassy in D.C. I would never ask any of you to go watch that video. It's horrific. It's horrific. But if you have, you know that towards the end of that video that the sort of security apparatus shows up. And you've got one guy asking for a fire extinguisher, asking for something. And another guy pointing his gun at the flames. And insofar as I'm going to talk to my kids at some point about how to be in the world, I will try to explain that throughout their lives, going forward, there are going to be so many benefits to being the kind of person who points their gun at the flame. Or, more to the point, allow someone else to hold the gun to the flame on their behalf. And that despite all of those benefits, the best thing they can do to be a force for some kind of positive change in the world is to try and be the person who's reaching for the fucking fire extinguisher. That is the closest I have come to trying to figure out what I want to tell them about how to be in the world. But that is also coming from a place of profound embarrassment, because it should not be the case that I have to tell them any of this. We screwed up, and that's why this is happening. But that is the closest I have come to answering the question you've asked, and it's a very big non-answer, and I apologize for that.
Ladies and gentlemen, please, will you join me in thanking once again Omar Alakat.
Omar Alakat, journalist and author of the book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This, written in response to Israel's war on Gaza, a war that has so profoundly affected so many people across Australia and around the world and in the region itself. If you'd like to let us know your thoughts, your reflections on this conversation, perhaps you've read the book, perhaps you saw Omar speak while he was touring in Australia. We always love hearing from you. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au. Omar was speaking at the recent Canberra Writers' Festival with host, journalism professor and former foreign correspondent Peter Grester. His latest book is called The Correspondent, about the fight for press freedom in Egypt and around the world. It's now a film starring Richard Roxburgh, which is a reminder to me that I really want to see that. And thanks to the festival for sharing that conversation with us. This is Big Ideas. We are your front row seat to the best live events with big thinkers. And the show is produced by Claire Slattery, Karin Savanovitz, and me, your host, Natasha Mitchell. And the show is mixed by sound engineer David LeMay. Thank you for your company. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.